Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So SF-86 forms are back in the news this week. This is your security clearance form.
Yeah.
But if you've ever worked in a restaurant, do you know what being 86'd means?
I always think of 86ing as like, but I don't think of it as restaurant specific. I think of it as like axing or killing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like being, we're done. You've been crossed off.
Yeah.
You are no longer available to be served to customers or be seen in polite
but
society.
But is that just a restaurant term? I think of it as like, almost like, you know, he was fine, and then, you know, he got 86'd him. He got 86'd.
As a, I've asked the magic box.
Yeah, all of human knowledge at our fingertips.
Exactly. That is Wikipedia, and it says that according to Merriam-Webster, 86 is a slang term used in American popular culture as a transitive verb to mean throw out or get rid of. The most widely accepted theory of the term's origin states it derives from a code supposedly used in restaurants, meaning we're all out of it.
Wow, so it is a restaurant term.
We are not all out of Mike Flynn, though.
No, although Trump did SF-86
him. He did 86 Mike Flynn over his bad Porsche. Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the SF-86 edition. I'm Shane Harris of The Wall Street Journal. Those are almost as in, it could be the MF-86.
It's actually Mike really Flynn. Hard to say SF-86.
SF-86.
SF-86. Say that 6 times fast.
Oh, no, thank you. I haven't started drinking my scotch yet.
We have big scotch news in object lessons.
We do.
On this.
Stay tuned for that. I mean, we're sort of enjoying it, as is our wont, here in the jungle studio before that, but we will fill you in on why
but
this scotch is different than all other
scotches. This scotch is special, and I also want to say that special advance shout out to the Rational Security listener who sent us this scotch. The story will be on Object Lessons, but I want to say she is a model to you all.
Yes. Pay attention, children. I'm here in the studio, in the Jungle Scotch studio, with my friends Ben Wittes, Susan Hennessy, and joining us this week, Quinta Jurassic, audio engineer.
Hello, hello.
Host, guest.
I wear many hats.
Not scotch drinker.
Between the audio engineering and the participation, drinking scotch as well just seemed like a lot. Like,
but I think it would be awesome if you were like tossing back scotch while recording Rational Security.
We're going to save that for another episode.
Drops out halfway through.
I think, look, I know this is like heretical to admit, but I'm not really that much of a scotch fan. So I feel like other contingent of Rational, like we should bring in, like there should be like a gin.
I would be very much in favor of that.
Like a Civil War.
The scotch in my office, because that's what I like to drink while doing work. But if you guys, you and Tammy and Quinta, want to have a different drink.
It seems a bit weird if it's also divided by gender lines, though.
But I
feel like we have to mix it up.
I do want to point out that the Bombshell podcast, where they really spend time discussing at the outset of each episode what they're drinking, suggests the value of a diversity of drinks.
Exactly. They mix it up. They think it through.
They do. Yeah.
Well, we can make it seasonal. We need to have like a rosé on the podcast next week, or like a gin with some like artisanal tonic.
Or maybe whatever the next reader decides to send us.
Oh,
hint.
Or like frat party jungle juice, you know, just like Kool-Aid and just like
Purple
whatever
Jesus.
Disgusting.
Hunch punch.
That's what Mike Flynn is drinking right now.
Mike Flynn is drinking solo cups full of purple juice.
No, Ben. Mike Flynn is drinking vodka.
Mike Flynn is hanging out at Morton's drinking martinis. But I don't know if it's very good. It's probably vodka, not expensive vodka, though. Yeah, Russian vodka. Not from Texas. This week on the podcast, Mike Flynn is back in hot water over money he took from foreign sources. naughty, naughty. It's not naughty to take it. It's just naughty not to tell anyone you took
not
it.
Not to SF-86.
Not to SF-86 that money. The Senate Intelligence Committee is beefing up for a long investigation of Russian meddling in the election, and FBI Director Jim Comey is back in the spotlight again this week amid questions of how he handled the Clinton and Trump investigations. Let's start with MF-86. So, Mike Flynn...
Wait, we actually have somebody here who has filled out an SF-86.
I have filled out an
SF-86. Okay, so...
Let's with each thing that we point out about what's been reported about Mike Flynn, let's ask Susan about how she handled that on her SF-86.
Okay, so here's what we learned this week. Based on the House Oversight Committee getting a hold of his FS-86 security clearance renewal form from January 2016, apparently he did not report that he took money from RT, the propaganda arm of the Russian government.
Okay, let's start there. Susan, did you on your SF-86 report all of the money you got from RT for attending a dinner in which you sat next to Vladimir Putin?
I did. I 100% disclosed the many, many dollars that were paid to me by the Russian government.
Yeah.
Okay. It's all there. There is data. I have complied with the
okay.
law.
It's not
as just Jason Chaffetz pointed out at a press conference.
Exactly. The absence of evidence, as Chairman Chaffetz pointed out, leads him to think there's something amiss. Did not, as far as we know, not that he would have done it on the January 2016 form because this work came later, but there apparently there's no record of him having disclosed money that he took to lobby on behalf of the Turkish government in the United States.
Okay, Susan, did you fully disclose on your SF-86 all the money that you took from Recep Tayyip Erdogan to lobby on behalf of the Turkish state?
I mean, I'll have to double check, but I'm almost positive that I've disclosed all of my Erdogan funds.
And were those paid in Turkish lira or in U.S. dollars?
I get paid in euros. Just, you know.
Yeah.
I like to keep a fund in better foreign exchange currency.
Rate. Susan, what a globalist you are.
And there's no evidence that we can find that he sought permission from either the Secretary of State or the Department of the Army to take money from foreign governments as was required, given that he is a former military officer.
So again, when you took all this foreign money that you reported on your SF-86, did you get General, I guess it would have been General Alexander or more Mike Rogers?
I am not a retired military officer, and I do not collect a pension. So I am not, I would not be subject to the Foreign Emoluments Clause. So I did not seek permission, nor am I obligated to.
Well, in that case, there you go.
So foreign governments, call me.
Send Susan money.
I don't even need permission.
So a lot of this was just confirming, I think, what has largely been reported. But what it does create now is a point of very particular vulnerability for Mike Flynn, namely that he may have failed to disclose relevant information on his security clearance form, which can get you sent to jail. I don't think there was any question that he was not being completely forthcoming about his contacts with the Russians, but after we now know that he has been looking for immunity from the FBI and from Senate and House investigators in exchange for his testimony, it seems to me that this might be, in fact, one of the points that he is worried about, that he might be prosecuted for failing to disclose, you know, material conflicts or pertinent information on a security clearance form, which, by the way, he held as the former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, as all former directors do. So the current director of the agency is able to consult with him and speak with him about the most sensitive information the director is handling.
Yeah. So I think the story actually gets worse for General Flynn here, not better. Right. So remember that all of that, which is what we learned today, this week, emerges against a backdrop of not having registered as a foreign agent until retroactively with respect to the Turkey payments, as well as having apparently lied to the vice president about his contacts with the Russian ambassador in reference to sanctions, in the context of these payments that were not disclosed on his SF-86. And so when you put it all together, you get a as a prima facie matter, a very disturbing pattern of foreign financial entanglements with adversarial governments, failure to disclose them in a proper fashion, failure to do proper registrations, and three, in at least one case, active misrepresentation about it. And you put that picture together, it's a very strange picture for a guy who was the national security advisor to the president.
Yeah, so I think that people are sort of assuming that the only issue here is reporting these payments. The S-586 asks a lot of questions. They ask for any foreign travel, foreign contacts you've had.
It's a 70-page form,
any
right?
Any form. Yeah. I think it can even populate it further because sometimes
it's
if you say
yes, it
expands.
It's the wire brush treatment. Yeah, it's everything.
Right, and so, I mean, it doesn't just ask you any foreign payments. It asks if you ever have even been offered a job by any foreigner, right? I mean, this is unbelievable. Or your spouse has been offered jobs. I mean, it's unbelievably detailed disclosure. And so this is not a thing in which, like, you can just, whoops, you accidentally forget to list something.
Jared Kushner claims you did.
This is something that you really, like, you have to answer dozens of questions related to contacts with foreigners. And so all we know now is that there's no evidence that he complied with the law. Thank you, Chairman Chaffetz. That could mean a lot in this space. It seems like at the very minimum, it means that he hasn't disclosed these payments. And of course, he has now because he's retroactively registered under FARA. He has disclosed, right, that he accepted the payments in at least one venue. So you can hold that up against his FS-86 forms. You know, the administration and then the Trump administration, their response to this appears to be pointing to the fact that he was DIA director under Obama.
So, like, Obama people should have checked it out?
Yeah, well, like Obama was the first person to trust this guy. Like, you know, why are you only coming to us? Well, it seems like pretty much everything that occurred after he left, after he was fired by the Obama administration.
And he was fired, let's remember.
Then it's, they are sort of representing that they're not responsible for anything that happened during the transition period, right? Well, it was before January 20th. We weren't in the White House at the time. I mean, it was sort of this Sean Spicer was essentially representing that they weren't responsible for vetting their national security advisor.
But meanwhile, they also like to defend the fact that he had conversations with the Russian ambassador because that's what the designated national security
advisor
should be doing.
The other thing that's a little bit overlooked is this isn't just about the transition period. In the period of time in which he is being paid as a lobbyist, as a foreign agent for Turkey, he is getting access to classified security briefings because Donald Trump was bringing him into classified security briefings with him. And so, you know, the notion that somehow this doesn't reflect on Donald Trump's judgments and that he isn't responsible for this, that's just absurd. There are a number of explanations here, all of which strike me as really bad news for the White House. So the first one is Mike Flynn lied on his SF-86 forms, which is a felony, by the way, and it says so right on the form. And the White House knew it and retained him as national security advisor anyway. Didn't care. Okay, that's pretty bad news. The other possibility is that they didn't know that he had accepted these payments, and therefore they didn't know that the form was not correctly filled out. That sort of seemed like what Sean Spicer was saying yesterday, when he's like, well, everybody's responsible for filling out their own forms. Seems unlikely because we know there was discussion about the FARA stuff with Don McGahn, who basically said, oh, that's your own problem, and because it was publicly reported. So that suggests that they didn't even, I don't know, Google their national security advisor before offering him one of the most sensitive national security positions in the entire federal government.
Google's not adequately secure.
That's true. They're putting his name in. So that's bad news. The other possibility is that they knew he took the payments, weren't concerned about that, which is a whole other can of worms, but didn't realize that he'd lied on the form because they didn't see the forms. So that's not great news, because it means that something is wrong with their process where they're not adequately vetting people with access to really, really sensitive information. So you can see sort of the White House spinning, and it's not quite clear where they're going to land in terms of their explanation, but they strike me as all bad news stories for the White House.
Well, there's also the fact that the part of the reason that Representatives Chaffetz and Cummings held their joint press conference yesterday was that they'd sent the White House a letter asking for information about Flynn's security clearance and any contacts he might have had with foreign officials, information which the White House then refused to provide, right. Which also, like, again, isn't probative of anything, but really just does not look good.
Well, actually, I think it is probative.
Yeah, well, in fact, Cummings even said that there's information of a classified nature we can't discuss, but we saw things at the Defense Intelligence Agency where you might imagine there were things like records of his travel and other things that he did after he was DIA director that were greatly troubling to us. So it's not just the SF-86. There's this other category of information that they're saying raises all kinds of questions too. And then the fact that the White House won't disclose certain information.
Right. So I think the atmospherics of yesterday's press conference are fascinating and highly probative. So Jason Chaffetz is not going to be the guy who, when backbone awards are handed out, is going to be at the front of the line.
Nor is he going to be the chairman much longer.
Right. And he's somebody who has been all over the place with respect to Donald Trump. And he has an extremely historically adversarial relationship with Elijah Cummings. And yesterday, they were standing shoulder to shoulder, professing being very disturbed by what they'd seen and by and granted, he did formulate it in the double negative, but Chaffetz was evidently accusing Flynn of noncompliance with the law. And the White House is refusing to give them the information that they want, which, by the way, may be within the White House's right to do. They are forcing Republican chairmen who will bend over backwards to be sympathetic and to be protective of their interests, not to be sympathetic and not to be protective of their interests. And that's a remarkable development in my view. If the White House can't keep somebody like Jason Chaffetz, they're going to have problems with Congress in the investigative sense sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, this just falls in sort of the I see people sort of the question mark of so what, right? Like, what does this mean? This strikes me as such a consequential thing. The fact that it's been occurring in plain sight a little bit has masked how significant it is. And that's that, you know, there are individuals within the Trump administration who are not confirmed, in whom, you know, we asked the president to use his judgment in ways that are enormously consequential to national security. I mean, these are the actual secrets you really have to keep. And not just on sort of the secrecy and loyalty metric, but also people that are sensible, that, right, they themselves have shown them that are sort of capable stewards of this information and have shown good judgment through the course of their career. And it really said something to me so significant about Donald Trump as president of the United States that he hired Mike Flynn as national security advisor. And that is something that the White House really wants to move on. They're kind of like, well, come on, he was national security advisor for like 20 days. What's the big deal? You know, that decision, it's an important one. It's important when we sort of get to the bottom. And the nature of political accountability is supposed to be such that Trump personally is supposed to hold responsibility for these staffers. And it's surprising to me how much they're getting away with just kind of shrugging this off as like, that's old news. Who cares about this? He lied to us. They hired this person over unbelievable red flags, and there was not enough was made about it at the time, and I don't think that people are going back to sort of examine the original decision at this point as much as they should be.
And just as a postscript to that before we go on to the next topic, Mike Flynn was also seriously considered and publicly slow for vice president of the United States. They considered him as a running mate for Donald Trump. So that would have been.
Well, it shows what great judgment the president has that he went with Mike Pence instead.
Yeah,
and we could have had Chris Christie.
So just ponder that, and very much to your point of, you know, saying he only was here for 20 days, he was one of the most trusted people in the entire campaign.
Well, and the real question is, who else is in the administration that has serious, serious red flags that were overlooked?
All right. So we saw a couple of stories this week that said the sky is falling. The Senate Intelligence Committee investigation of Russian meddling in the election is basically not making any progress. I exaggerate for dramatic effect, or maybe I don't. The question really is, I think it comes down to these various stories point out something I think all sides do agree on, is that the number of investigators that have been assigned to the committee's investigation is pretty darn low. And there probably is just simply not enough manpower and expertise to get all of this done in a timely manner. But Ben, you did some looking into this week and wrote about this on Lawfare as well. So what are you finding is the sticky wickets here as the Senate Intel Committee tries to get moving, which, remember, people are sort of counting on that as the one that's going to make progress, because the House Intelligence Committee, after darkness at newness and all of that, Michigas did seem to come off the rails.
So look, there's a few things going on here, and they're distinct. Number one is the fact that this committee investigation is badly, badly understaffed.
So we're talking about seven investigators here.
Well, seven investigators, none of whom is full-time.
Right. Who have other things to do.
And they all have other things to do. The committee has competing responsibilities, and it has not notably staffed up in response to this. Now, Susan and I actually warned about this problem very explicitly when we wrote in favor of a select committee as the proper investigative mechanism here. The committees of jurisdiction are not designed for this kind of investigation, particularly not if you want to get it done in a timely fashion. So that aspect of the complaint has a lot of merit. Chairman Burr and Vice Chairman Warner really need to think about how they want to staff this thing, both for the reality and the perception of getting it done in a serious way and showing commitment to it and getting it done in a timely fashion. The stories, however, have at least two other dimensions that I am much less convinced have merit. So one is that there are certain Democrats on the committee, and the stories are, you know, aspects of them are evidently the product of Ron Wyden. They are trying to raise questions about whether the committee is really functioning in an expeditious and bipartisan fashion, or whether Burr is slow walking the thing or not really committed to it. And I am not particularly convinced that aspect of the stories and the complaints has a lot of merit. I think Burr obviously doesn't have quite the sense of urgency about it that Wyden does. I haven't seen any evidence apart from his initial stumble that he is anything other than sincere in wanting to conduct a serious investigation. And the second element of it is, this idea that the committee has been focused initially on reviewing the intelligence community's findings rather than, quickly moving to interview witnesses. And on this, I am really not sympathetic to the complaint. I think that's a sign of doing your homework to really understand the state of the art, of the prior art, before you go rush to put somebody under oath, who may then demand immunity in exchange for conversation. I mean, knowing what you can, what you know and what you don't know and what prior investigations have and have not produced seems to be the better part of valor. And so I'm quite convinced, and in fact was convinced before these stories, that there are staffing problems and they need to be resolved. And if the committee wants to be taken seriously as the mechanism, they're going to have to resolve these issues and they're going to have to staff it like they mean to take this seriously. The rest of it, I'm less convinced is anything other than the sort of members who are least sympathetic to the chairman, trying to put pressure on him by making complaints that, you know, may have less merit than the fervor with which they're making them.
Yes, I think it's important to note that this is all sort of unfolding against the background of Burke created a little bit of a hole that he had to get out of. And that was a few months ago, weeks ago. God, time has like collapsed on itself. At White House direction, Richard Burke got on the phone with certain reporters who shall remain nameless and tried to sort of throw cold water on a New York Times story that Trump team or Trump campaign officials had been in, I think, quote, constant contact with Russian intelligence, right? So not just Russian individuals, but Russian intelligence officials or agents. And so that was participating in that really struck a pretty significant blow to the credibility of the SSCI investigation, which had previously been viewed as quite serious and bipartisan. Since then, so we saw, right, so Burr got in a little bit of trouble. Nunes got in a little bit of trouble. Nunes decided to keep on digging and just, you know, go all the way down. Burr.
He was exploring.
Exactly. He just wanted to see how low he could get. You know, Burr, I think wisely said, you know what? Maybe I shouldn't have been on that phone call. Took a step back, actually comported himself quite well and in quite a reassuring way in the SSCI open hearings, you know, asked serious questions, gave a good press conference with Mark Warner. He really did take steps to try and preserve or reinforce the sort of sense of legitimacy of his investigation. And so I think that there's, right, the idea that Burr is trying to obstruct or slow walk this, that I agree, I'm not quite, I don't see that. There is one thing that was reported that I do think is alarming in terms of whether or not this really is structured to be a credible investigation. And that's that they've determined that only the seven investigators are going to have access to all of the relevant classified material. Presumably, this is Gang of Eight material that we're talking about, and that they will not be allowed to share them with other members of the committee. So that is not usual, even in investigations.
But there's some they can share, right? I mean, there's some that's been made available beyond the Gang of Eight, just not everything.
Right, but the sort of that the understanding, or at least as reported, is not that, you know, they're going to go in and they're going to do this investigation and they're going to take what they find back to the committees and the minority and majority and be able to share with other staffers, but that it's like, right, this really is a closed world investigation even within SSCI. Considering sort of already the staffing constraints, that really strikes me as one, not being justified. Now, it might have been a concession to the intelligence community, especially if it was about, hey, you want access to super, super, you know, sensitive stuff here, and we aren't going to give all of your staff access to that. Maybe. But in other ways, it's hard to imagine a successful investigation operating under those constraints, because the people who can conceivably be staffed to this investigation are not the most senior members of the committee, who, by the way, have the most important other responsibilities and are the least replaceable in their roles. And so that strikes me as a decision that is constrains this investigation in really difficult ways. And I don't see a ton of justification for it, unless for some reason the area in which they are investigating implicates a very, very narrow and unlikely subset of information. So those are sort of, I agree with Ben, I don't quite buy it, especially on the Burr part, but there are also signs coming out that this is not, we shouldn't be holding our breath for the SSCI to deliver the masterful, full account of everything that happened.
We shouldn't also expect it soon.
Yeah. I mean, so this is my question is, I feel like in much the same way as Chairman Nunes's bizarre behavior sort of forced Sissy to take the lead and be the adults in the room. We're now in this situation where Nunes so thoroughly destroyed the House investigation that there's now not only a lot of pressure on the Senate investigation to do this right, but a lot of the legitimacy in the eyes of the public of Congress's ability to investigate this issue at all is now riding on the Senate investigation. And so I think that means two things. I think first off, it means that people are more likely to flip out when there are signs that something is going slowly because everyone has the sort of the amp cranked up to 11. So that when there's a hitch, we're more likely to go to, oh my God, this is terrible. Something is deeply wrong. We're seeing Nunes 2.0. And second, I wonder if it actually, so Senator James Lankford tweeted in response to a lot of these stories, don't confuse silence with a lack of progress.
Right.
So that's really interesting because under normal situation, you might say, like, it's good to do this quietly and take your time and be careful and not be overly public about it before you have to and do the work. In this case, I wonder if there actually is paradoxically a premium on communicating clearly with the public that the investigation is going forward. To keep people from panicking. The problem is that I wonder if that's actually in tension with the credibility of the investigation. So I'd be interested to know what any of you think about that, because it really seems to me that they're in a tight spot.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, how much can they actually come out and talk about it without suddenly looking like they're opening the door to talking about an ongoing investigation? I can say from my own reporting, I think that people who would say that the investigation is not making progress are wrong. I think it is making progress. The problem is that this is a slog. And it's helpful to think about what it is that the investigation is actually looking at. And it's essentially three tranches of information. First, it's intelligence reports, including, highly, highly sensitive classified source reports that were a part of the intelligence community's assessment that Russia meddled in the elections and all the things that we read about publicly. And as part of that, by the way, the investigators are interviewing intelligence agency analysts who helped write and craft those findings and asking them, why did you think this here? Why did you think that there? So they're trying to go back and essentially, put themselves back in the shoes of the people who created these findings. The second tranche is stuff that, as it's been described, even Senator Warner has used this phrase, that was left on the cutting room floor, that the Obama administration didn't have a chance to get to because it was in an all-hands effort to put out a public top-line assessment of Russian meddling and to achieve a consensus on that. That will be kind of the second tranche. And then the third is going to be, if they get this far, information from some of the key players. So Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, Mike Flynn, Carter Page, people who've been sent preservation requests to hang on to their emails and other relevant information. But that set of documents will be another part of it. This is going to take upwards of 2 years to get through all this. The FBI very well may be done with its investigation before the Senate finishes it. This is partly why it's a slog. And I think because of that, and because these investigators are part-time and not necessarily are all expert in precisely the kind of things we're talking about here, you've seen now the committee, it was announced today, not by the committee, but by a law firm, that a former senior NSA lawyer, April Doss, who was the top intelligence policy lawyer.
And Lawfare contributor.
She's the top lawyer for intelligence law.
Right, for intelligence law at the NSA, is going to be a special counsel to the committee and will be working with the Democrats. Essentially, I think it's probably fair to say that she will effectively become the staff lead, if not in name, then in practice for this. And I wouldn't be surprised if you saw the committee bring on other former officials who are now practicing law to help with this and beef up what is clearly, I think everyone would agree, a fairly shallow bench of people that have to get this huge job done.
So I also just want to say that I think it is a little bit too early to count out the House side, not because there's anything to say in defense of our friend Devin. There isn't. But because he's actually out of the picture. And the, you know, the House Intelligence Committee has sometimes in the past gone through spasms of grotesque partisanship. And the people who follow that period often make a very concerted effort, and the relationship between former Chairman Rogers and former Vice Chairman Ruppelsberger to really run the thing in a bipartisan fashion is an example of that, that followed a period of partisan rancor on the committee. And, you know, right now you have the Republican chairman having behaved in a really embarrassing fashion and having had to recuse himself, and now he has to defend that in front of the Ethics Committee. And, you know, the people who have stepped up to follow that are cannot be unaware of the burden that is on their shoulders to make the committee look at least a little bit less ridiculous. And so when they have their next hearing coming up, and it's coming up soon, and it could be very damaging to the president, I think it'll be really interesting to watch whether we once again see there being two completely different investigations, one that's all about the substance of the material and one that's all about leaks, or whether you have some effort to have something more that looks a little bit more like what the Senate side has looked like.
Yeah, so look, I think people should view April's hiring with as a real reassurance. She's somebody who is really respected and has a lot of credibility within the intelligence community. She was, you know, the top lawyer for intelligence, so she knows the way the law works and isn't going to be fooled by any kind of executive branch sleight of hand here. You know, she also has the relationships with people, which tends to be really, really important in investigations like this, of knowing who to pick up the phone and call, you know, when someone's being straight with you, when they aren't. You know, the last thing I'd say is I really do not believe that she has prejudged the outcome of the investigation. So that, and that's going to be critical, especially for the Democrats, that we've talked a lot about legitimacy on the other side, right? That is, are they really looking into it? And, you know, has Trump interfered? And is it independent? And are they getting to the truth? There is another part where it could become illegitimate. And that's where if it actually is perceived as a witch hunt, or it's viewed as, right, the Democrats
the
going out.
The Benghazi effect.
Exactly, yeah. And trying to find any damning evidence they can. You know, she, just because she's been hired by the minority, I really do believe, and having seen her, you know, having written stuff with her publicly recently, and having you know, seen her work within the intelligence community, that she is going to approach this with the mindset of an intelligence officer, and that's not prejudging the conclusion and just trying to sort of get to the truth. That is going to be a really important part of having a credible outcome, whatever it ends up being.
So FBI Director Jim Comey was the subject of a long, long New York Times profile this week, which essentially sought to, I guess, reposition, reframe everything we know about how Comey behaved with regards to the Clinton email investigation, the Russia investigation, the decision points at which he decided to go public, not go public. I have to say it was probably, in the end, a pretty hard piece on Comey, I thought, the upshot of which was that it was essentially making the case, I thought, and you guys maybe will think differently, that there were these kind of key inflection points that you had to wonder if he had it to do over again, would he have just kept quiet, or what did he think that it was the right thing to weigh in on the progress of various investigations. One thing that I thought was probably a bit of new news, and there wasn't a lot of new information in the story, I thought, besides we did learn the code name of the Hillary Clinton investigation. What was it, Mayfair?
Was it Mayfair? I don't remember.
It wasn't memorable.
That's news right there.
Yeah, it was May Day. One thing I thought was interesting in this is that, I mean, clearly the FBI did not think that Donald Trump was going to win. And I detected, and maybe I'm just reading between the lines too much, some sense that in fact did have at least some influence on their decision to come public, for Jim Comey's decision to go public, the way he did in back in July, and give out all the reasons why that they were not prosecuting a case against Hillary Clinton, but all the things that she'd done. He seemed to at least be anticipating the political reality that he thought was coming and trying to do his job at the same time. And I thought the story did a pretty good job of painting a picture of an FBI director who has been walking a tightrope for the better part of the past, 9 months, at least publicly with this. I don't know. What did you guys think?
So look, I thought the story was very long relative to the amount of new information that it developed and delivered, which was rather small. That said, I thought the authors did a good job of describing the constraints under which he was operating and the very narrow space in which he was wedged and the problems which he anticipated and felt would come back, and the effort he made to try to navigate that very narrow space, operating room. People are going to argue about this for a long time, whether he, did the right thing, what his motives were, the article changed nothing for me, which is that I believe he acted in good faith. I believe he acted in public for exactly the reasons he has said publicly that he did. I think he's a guy, one of the few people in Washington who's essentially subtextless. That is, if he tells you he did something for reason X, it's actually because he did something for reason X. And you can argue till the cows come home about whether that was a good thing to do or a bad thing to do, both in July and in October, late October, and then in November. But it's what he did. And what the story reveals is that he kind of did it for exactly the set of reasons that he said he did it. And so I actually thought the story was sort of weirdly unavailing in terms of delivering new information about the Comey story, because I think the Comey story was told a long time ago by Jim Comey.
Yeah, so I also didn't think there was lots new information here. And so by the time I got to the end, it's like an obscenely long article. I was reading quickly, so correct me.
The memo to the New York Times, editing.
Tighten that up, guys. So correct me, maybe like it's possible I just skipped this part, although I don't think so. And that's that there's a pretty big missing piece to the story that's told in this article. I agree with Ben that I am, right decision, wrong decision. I don't think it was, I do believe it was undertaken in good faith. The piece that I don't see being told that I think is incredibly significant, is the issue of leaks that came out of the FBI in the period immediately following the leak out of Congress about this investigation. So
about the reopening of the email investigation.
Exactly.
Quote-unquote reopening.
Right. So, what we have is the bombshell this letter, and I'll say that at the time I was, whenever this announcement was made, I was sitting having lunch with an Intelligence Committee staffer who picked up their phone, said an expletive, and said, "I will talk to you later," and left the restaurant. So that's how I learned of this letter for the first time. What happened immediately after that was there was this flood of competing leaks, like leaks and counterleaks, that pretty clearly came out of the FBI's New York field office, or individuals purporting to represent the FBI's New York field office, which maybe are not the same
including
thing.
Including Rudy Giuliani,
essentially saying that, no, this is very, very serious, right? There's all kinds of evidence that there's really bad stuff in here. And it became pretty clear pretty quickly, at least from my perspective, that actually these group of individuals had been attempting to shop this story for some period of time beforehand, and that nobody in the media was willing to run with it because it turns out, one, to have been factually untrue, and then clearly it couldn't have been corroborated. the fact of this letter suddenly made all of that reporting newsworthy, right? Or like it unleashed this set of leaks. And so I've always had the perception, and it's an assumption, and I don't know, that at least some of the calculation into the decision to tell Congress was a fear that this might leak anyway, and that it would be better to sort of be forthright with Congress at this point instead of risking the information getting out and it looking as though the FBI was hiding something. Those leaks that occurred sort of in the days afterwards, I think were incredibly damaging. I think they had as much of an outcome, sort of impact on the outcome of the election as anything else did. And of course, we can never know the counterfactual, and there can be multiple but-for causes, right? So but for the Comey letter, but for ignoring Wisconsin and Michigan, but for a candidate with historic unfavorables, but for it. There could be lots of things that if that didn't happen, the outcome would have been different. But that element of the story really strikes me as one that we've never had a full accounting of. There purportedly is a DOJ Inspector General's investigation into sort of the aftermath of this. I don't know if that will be public. But that part of it, that who in the FBI was the source of those leaks, and what was the role of the agency in that, in the period sort of immediately following, that strikes me as really critical, and I didn't see it picked up at all in this story.
Yeah, the story didn't really deal with that. I do think you hit on, though, something that's a really important element of this, which is that I think part of the psychological subtext of the desire to really understand the Comey story is the flip side of the much ballyhooed book Shattered about the Clinton campaign that was released this last week and got a lot of press. And, you know, there's sort of broadly two competing narratives, right, of the Trump victory and the Clinton loss in particular. There's the "it's all Comey's fault" narrative, and then there's the "actually no, Clinton sucked," or the "Clinton campaign sucked" narrative. And there were big developments in both of those versions this week. One is, you know, this New York Times story, which is, you know, the sort of effort to be the definitive, here's what Jim Comey did. And the other is this kind of expose or, and I haven't read the book, but really fleshing out just how dysfunctional the Clinton campaign apparatus really was, and how, I mean, I believe the word doomed appears in the subtitle of the book. I think we're gonna have this debate, and people are gonna invest a lot in it over a long period of time. And I just want to say, I think the debate's really stupid when you lose an election by a small number of votes in a small number of states. It's a multivariate cause, and you change, if the candidate hadn't sucked, it wouldn't have mattered what Jim Comey did. And if Jim Comey hadn't sent a letter, it might not have mattered that the candidate was dysfunctional, or the apparatus of the campaign was dysfunctional. And a thousand other things. By the way, if Trump had been a little bit less brazen as a liar, he might not have gotten elected. And I, you know, with Obama on interrogation, I want to say people should be looking forward, not backward on this.
Yeah, I mean, it honestly, at this point, just reading these stories about Jim Comey, what happened? Here's the ticking clock, just makes me want to claw out my own eyes. It feels like we're in, like, it's Groundhog Day. It's like Prometheus chained to the rock, and every day the eagle comes and eats your liver. Like this new chain, eternal return. Like every few months,
Comey the rock.
There's
the
just
eagle.
No. He's,
I just want to point
I'm
out
really
nobody
sure
ever
he
looks
is.
At
I
that think story from the eagle's point of view.
Eagles gotta heat, man.
When you're a star, they let you do it. Yeah. No, it's
grab him by
just
the liver.
You know, as parts of anatomy go.
It's the grab them by the liver edition.
No, look, it feels like picking a scab. Like there's a Comey story, and then like 2 months go by and everyone kind of like forgets about it, and Comey does, you know, something, he testifies in front of the House Intelligence Committee, and then we all talk about Comey and Russia, and then someone writes a TikTok story about Comey in the letter, and we pick off the scab again, and it bleeds a little bit, and everyone says, ah, Clinton, like, she was terrible. No, she was great. It was Comey. Like, there's this element of this that is just, like, reliving the trauma again and again, and it kind of feels like we're trying to figure out, like, where in the timeline it all went wrong so we can like get back into the proper universe. But it just, it feels, I want to say I understand the instinct, like from a historical perspective, absolutely. But it just, it's so drawn out and painful. And there's an extent to which it just, at my most pessimistic moments, it just feels like picking a scab. Like, that's what it is.
I feel like that's also partly the nature of journalism, too, is that, you know, we often talk about it being the first draft of history, but there are second and third drafts that we create as well. And I mean, look, if I'm looking at this purely from the point of view of somebody who works in a newsroom that competes directly with the New York Times, everybody was looking at that story saying, yeah, it didn't have anything new in it. At the same time, I'm like, that's a pretty good idea to write that story. I mean, to do the sort of the 5,000 word try to be, as Ben put it, you know, the definitive story of what we know on Comey. You know, I also think that it's because we didn't learn that much new. I think it's a reflection of, there are no easy answers, and we sort of know the story because Jim Comey has told it to a large degree. But, you know, I agree with your point too, Quinta, that I mean, it does feel like picking off the scab, in part because it is a wound that has not healed, and we are still seeking for answers.
Right,
why did he do this, and what did he know about Russia, and why was there this apparent double standard, if it was a double standard? And I think that does reflect, to the extent that journalists are trying to reflect the questions that people are asking out there in the world, and we don't always do a great job of that, you know, some real lingering questions among the public too of what the hell happened. I mean,
right, it just feels like staring at the sky and saying, like, why, God, why?
Yeah, but
and God says, Jim Comey, probably, like, over and over again.
But I don't view this as, I view this as sort of a more different people trying to shape the narrative here.
And well, that always happens.
One thing that definitely wasn't included in this story is the New York Times's own role in how all of this was covered. Not just the fact that they covered Clinton's emails, but actually they were the ones who ran the story saying FBI sees no ties between Trump camp and Russia. They broke some of the most consequential stories that whenever we were starting to see the early sort of little glimmers of what we now know to be really significant stories, the New York Times itself killed those stories by publishing these front page blockbusters. And so the lack of examination about their own role in this, it doesn't feel like this sort of looking back and really trying to get to the bottom of it. It feels like trying to shape a narrative that is not, for which they have no responsibility.
But Susan, it's just because all the stories about the negative stories about their own role, those are all fake news.
Yeah, exactly. No, the fakest of fake
news. So they're only all the news that's fit to print. They don't publish fake news. If you say anything bad about them, that's fake news. Therefore, they wouldn't cover them. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. In terms of sort of the Comey obsession, and I, you know, like, look, we'll see like Jim Comey coloring books by the end of the.
See, that's exactly what I mean.
I said at the greeting card, I got a lot of positive feedback about the Jim Comey subtext list greeting cards. Where it's like I'm acknowledging your birthday. a lot of listeners were big fans of that. So now the coloring book will be the next one. Look, like it or not, Jim Comey is an individual who, in significant ways, will have shaped the course of history, and that's, you know, maybe we can someday get the answer of like that he. She would have lost anyway, but I think we all understand that he, without any of us realizing it at the time, and certainly without him realizing it at the time, has shaped the world. And so, you know, whenever it's relatively rare that we can zoom back to the one moment in which a world-altering decision was made, even though we know world-altering decisions are made all the time. And so I do think it's natural to be drawn almost obsessively to wanting to understand that moment, in part because we know that we're going to reach those moments in the future. You know, so I think we'll see many more Jim Comey, I don't know, biographies,
coloring books.
God help us all.
For all the action future figures. Biographers, he's tall.
Stretch Armstrongs. Call me Stretch Armstrongs.
Let's move on to object lessons. Ben, do you want to tell us the story of the object finally?
So last week we had the cask strength edition where we drank cask strength whiskey. And Shane and I sang the praises of cask strength scotch. And a thoroughly excellent reader whom we have to have a shout out to protect privacy. I'm going to keep her name out of it. But sent us a bottle of Aberlour non-chill filtered. And it is, we are drinking it today, and it is lovely.
It is delicious.
And she sent it by app.
And she sent it. Here's, that's the coolest thing about it.
There's an app for this?
There is an app for that. For sending whiskey to people. my object lesson is, first of all, the bottle of scotch that we're, but secondly, they don't sponsor us or anything, but I want to have a shout out to the app Drizzly.
Drizzly.
Where you can send a bottle of single malt cask strength Aberlour to a podcast of your choice.
And you have to show ID when you pick it up, though.
Yeah,
as we learned.
But I just want to say to it's not very often that, you know, we often point out people who are not sponsoring us and call them out on it. But Drizzly, this one's for you because you have enabled listeners to send whiskey to Rational Security, and that is a huge public service.
And that reader, that listener, is sponsoring us too.
Exactly.
In more ways than than we can count.
So thanks so much to the listener in question, and thanks as well to the fact of Drizzly. And gosh, if any other listeners want to send us whiskey, we are here. We are at the Brookings Institution, and Rational Security this week is brought to you by Drizzly.
Quite literally.
In so many ways.
Quinta?
So I have not one but two objects, and they are both of the King's Two Bodies, or as I have termed them, the King's Two Twitter accounts, which is the subject of a piece that I published on Lawfare 2 days ago about... So Donald Trump has two Twitter accounts. He has, of course, @RealDonaldTrump, which predates his presidency. I believe it's from 2009. And then he also tweets from @POTUS, which is the official presidential Twitter account, which President Obama held before him and was bequeathed unto Donald Trump along with the nuclear football at the moment he was inaugurated.
Which one comes first and is more and more deadly?
Which will cause the war first? That's the real question. No, so The King's Two Bodies is the title of this book by a historian called Ernst Kantorowicz, which is what he calls a work of medieval political theology. It's sort of the notion that you see in Shakespeare's history plays of the king sort of human self inhabiting this broader sort of abstracted second body of kingship in the sort of institutional sense. And my theory is that @POTUS is the king's sort of abstracted institutional body and @RealDonaldTrump is the king's personal body. And when I started having this conversation with Ben some time ago, it started off as a joke. And as we sort of spun it out, realized that there were actually some pretty serious implications to it in terms of, for example, when Trump tweets something nasty from @RealDonaldTrump, is he immune from suit in his capacity as president, or is that a personal tweet that he would not be immune for? All of these are potentially very interesting questions.
They are.
For example, are @RealDonaldTrump tweets evidence of the White House's policy? Can they be used in, for example, litigation to show evidence of the White House's policy? All of these are very interesting questions that I think Ben and I have, I wrote and Ben sort of spruced up with a great deal more mischief. but they are really genuinely sort of bizarre questions that we now find ourselves having to consider seriously, I think, as a result of the sort of through the looking glass world in which we now find ourselves living.
It's like we need like Norm Eisen and Floyd Abrams to have a baby and then create a lawyer that can answer that question.
That is not what we need.
From that horrifying thought, I want to just say this is an incredible essay, and it is as funny as it is serious. And if you have not yet read Quinta on the King's Two Bodies, you really should. It is worth your time.
All right. That brings us to the end of the show. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find our show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. Follow us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter at RATL Security. Whenever you download the podcast, please remember to leave a four to five star rating.
Whoa.
Preferably five
stars or bust.
86 stars.
Tell you what. Do this. Leave a four star rating in a review. Then download Drizzly. And then, you know, do what you will.
Now, Drizzly, you need to sponsor the podcast. We will.
I'll leave Drizzly a five-star rating.
This
right now.
Just a taste, so to speak, of what Rational Security can do for you.
I'm not sure we're selling it.
But
it's really heartfelt.
Leave us a five-star rating, please.
Or we will hunt you down
and pour scotch over you
and read you a very long essay about Jim Comey.
See, that's torture.
Our audio engineering guest this week is Quinta Jurassic. The show is produced and edited by Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Mike Flynn and the 86 Rubles. You like that?
No.
The Phantom Rubles, would that be better? The Missing Rubles?
How about the 86th?
I need a little something. The 86 babushkas.
Michael Flynn and the no data to confirm.
You know what? Mike Flynn might be starting a band because he needs to make some money.
How about Mike and Jason?
Mike who?
Mike and Jason.
Mike and Jason, the dynamic duo.
Yeah.
Jason and Elijah.
Our music is actually performed, of course, by Sophia Yan, who demands not to be paid in rubles. That is the one thing that she demands. She will not accept currency of Russian derivation, but she will be paid in Drizzly.
I mean, the value of the ruble is really oscillating, so that's probably why.
Sophia's really serious about scotch, actually.
Yeah, so, you know, she needs to find Drizzly because you can also use it to order scotch to yourself, which I might do right after this podcast. On behalf of my friends Quinta Jurassic, Susan Hennessy, and Ben Wittes, I'm Shane Harris. We'll talk to you next week.
Do svidaniya.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.